Hey, welcome to a new episode of Skin in the Game. I'm your host, John Simperman, with my co-host,
Sam O'Shai.
We've got a really special guest on the program today.
Yeah, we've got a Canadian legend, John, and I can't thank you enough for bringing him on. We're going to be talking to Bruce Kidd, who is many, many things, but he's a, you know, Olympic runner. He is a professor. He is an activist. Well, for a number of causes that we're going to get into with him, and you know, just a fascinating conversation.
Yeah, I didn't know much of Bruce until I dug into his work and his history and his accomplishments. Legend is the right word, and I really can't wait for our listeners to listen to our interview with Bruce and provide insights from his past career, as well as even what he's doing today to make a difference. Bruce, thanks for joining us on the program today.
Well, thank you, John. It's great to be with you.
I'm not quite sure, Tim, where to start with Bruce's career. Bruce, what was that moment where you had that shining light that you could start, or you would build your career around the sport of running? What was that moment? What was that time?
Well, it probably didn't happen until I was a teenager in high school. I love sport. I always wanted to be a professional athlete, first in baseball and then in hockey. I ran in school track meets, but not with a lot of success. But then in grade 10 at Malvern Collegiate in the East End of Toronto, everybody had to run a mile for the physical education class. And I went off at what I thought was a jog from the start, and very soon found myself all alone. And I turned around and nobody was close. As a result of that, the phys ed teacher, John Grab, encouraged me to run in the Malvern Interfaculty Cross Country Championship the following week. And the same thing happened. I jogged what seemed like a jog to me off the starting line, and very soon I was all alone. And I won that by 100, 200 yards. Now we say meters in Canada. So he took me the following week to the city championship, and I was well behind. But after the race, he said, "Bruce, everybody who was ahead of you had trained for this race, and you've never trained. If you train for this sport, you would be very well." And that's probably when the penny dropped. And I thought, maybe I love to run. I had several inspirations that were in the back of my mind. John Landy running at the 1954 British Empire Games against Roger Bannister, what was then called the Miracle Mile. He took off from the start like a deer. I'd never seen anything so lyrical, so exciting, so inspiring as the way he ran. And that always stuck in my head as a runner. And previously, my father had the opportunity of covering the 1952 Olympic Games for CBC Television. He was the very first CBC Television crew, filmmaker, producer, on-air commentator, because in the summer of 1952, CBC wasn't on television, but he was going to a nearby conference, and one of his friends in the CBC said, "If we show you how to film a race, would you shoot some footage for us?" And he thought he'd died and gone to heaven. He went to Helsinki. He shot about 15 hours of film. And when he went afterwards to the CBC studio to cut that down to an hour documentary, he took his 9-year-old son. And that was inspirational too. I'd always wanted to be a Major League Baseball player, but that's a North American sport. The Olympics is a world sport. Yeah. I never thought I'd ever have a chance, but when I started running in the summer of winter of 1958, 59, and I started thinking about who I could be in this brand new sport, I thought of myself as John Landy, and I thought of myself as running in the Olympics.
Wow.
Bruce, I'm thinking about the number of people I've known in my life when running comes up, whether they heard I'm a runner. I'm going to say I was a runner, nothing like you, but I used to love, I would love to go out for a great run. As somebody who just fell in love with it, it sounds like early and very, very deeply. What is it that when you're in the middle of a race and you're pushing and you're hurting, but you love it, what is it that you love?
Moving my body through time and space in a way that seems at one with the universe, that's lyrical, but that's how it feels. Sometimes I turn off my concentration and just look at myself, and I remember that being so exciting. And then there's the element of competition, and I was always a competitor. I always liked to jostle for position within a crowded race, make a burst and get away from other runners. So that element, which I had in every sport, kicked in too. I know people talk about the pain and digging deep and so on. Certainly, there were moments of discomfort, and certainly there were races that I ended in sheer exhaustion. But I never really dwelt on that because I love to run. And just being able to run at that level was such a high.
Well, and then I believe the ultimate high was 1964, Tokyo Games, representing your country. I can't imagine that. Tim, you cannot imagine that. We've had a few Olympians on Skin in the Game. But Bruce, tell us from your perspective, what was it like to represent your country on the biggest stage of all?
Well, John and Tim, it was both a tremendous high and it was the biggest disappointment of my running career. And in terms of the race, I did not do well. Other people that I beat, like Billy Mills, who won the 10, and Bob Scholl, who won the 5, wonderful American victories, I had beat previously. If I have any nightmares, I still have nightmares about why I didn't win those races. Those are races that I still want back. That being said, and you know, I warmed up in the village. I ran every morning with those other runners. But I didn't run the race that I had always dreamed about. That said, being there with the world, being engaged with other runners, learning about people from all over the world, not just the English-speaking world, which I knew well, because I'd run all across the United States, all across Europe, and certainly Australia. But I'd never encountered the world that included Asia and Africa in that way. And that was quite exciting. And as I've subsequently realized, as my friend John McAloon from the University of Chicago has always teased me about, in those Olympics, I transitioned from being a runner all by himself at the front to a journalist and a social scientist who was writing about it in a way of a participant observer. Mm-hmm. And this is not a story I like to tell very often, but when Billy Mills and Ron Clark, rivals whom I previously beat, lapped me in Tokyo, I moved out into lane 3 and I cheered them on. And John has always said that was my moment of transition. In a way, in an extraordinarily rich way, I made those Olympics a coming of age for myself as a journalist, as a scholar, as a writer. I was lucky enough to be asked to write a column that was syndicated by all university campus newspapers across Canada. I sent those stories back. I was engaging with other athletes in the village. I was visiting the other venues. I was doing the tourist things in Tokyo, like the fish market. I was encountering other Japanese and hearing their stories about the meaning of those games. And I was writing about it. And maybe that took my adrenaline that I was not conserving for my running. But it was an extraordinary experience in that way. In many profound ways, it changed my life. Prior to that, my professors in political science and economics at University of Toronto had always encouraged my running, but never let me write about sports. They thought sports was a playpen. They thought it was a nice cultural activity, perhaps, but never let me writing about sport. And I came back from Tokyo so convinced. I mean, Tokyo was this amazing political economic project. It was the centerpiece of what the Japanese did to rebuild Japanese society after the devastating losses and destruction of the war. They rebuilt Tokyo. They rebuilt the economy. They brought all these new electronic products online. They created the bullet train. They created the mono line subway out. They engaged in a national discussion about rebirth. And I came back and I said to several of these people that I really admired, you've got to let me write about this because this is political economy at the highest level. Most of them said, Bruce, go take a cold shower. But one of them, J.S. Dupré, said, you know, I'm open to you writing your graduating thesis on Canadian governments and sport. And that led to jobs, publications, speaking engagements in an entire new area. And that really opened the way for me making a career writing in the university about the political economy of sport. In addition, I had other influences that were lifelong that all started from Tokyo in 1964.
Bruce, you'll appreciate this. John, you and I talk so much on this program about how sports is a window into society. Sports is a window into the economy. Sports is a window into human nature. You know, Bruce, I'm even thinking just how decades later, even you still feel that loss, right? But you also still feel gratitude for the opportunity. And was there a point in society's progression, this will be a big question, when people started to recognize what it seems like clicked for you in 1964, that sports really is a window into much more than the game or the race or the competition itself?
I would say it's been slow and whatever the word is, periodic. During the 60s, when the civil rights movement was at its most intense period, I think many black athletes and their white allies began to make that point, and certainly many people got it. But there were long periods when people regarded sport as just, you know, this marginal activity, this entertainment that really wasn't very important. I think at the time when people ask for public money to build stadiums, they make the point. But when they talk about the best journalists in the country, they rarely include the amazingly perceptive sports journalists of your country and mine among the list of top journalists because sport is still the playpen or it doesn't cut it. I think about Toronto. I think about the way the downtown has been reconfigured around sport and the entertainment economy, hotels, restaurants, public transportation, and so on, that facilitate that, both enabled by it and enabling it.
Yeah, we're with Bruce Kidd, Canadian Sport Hall of Fame, Canadian Olympian, scholar, author. I can go on and on,
I was going
Bruce.
to say, yeah, there's much more where
But
that is.
Bruce, my favorite, I guess, moniker or title for you is Jock Raker. And you talked a little bit about using your profile, using sport as a platform to start digging into and being a voice for more of societal issues. At what point did you become a jock raker?
Well, it also took time, and I had to learn how to do it with, you know, respect and diplomacy. So what happened in Canada? I won races all over the United States and the world. Was twice chosen Canada's Male Athlete of the Year. Was a hero to many. As a result of that, there was always a CBC cameraman following me around. There were always journalists coming out to the track when I practiced. They do that for the NHL, but they never did that before for track and field athletes. But at least two or three times a week, one of the beat reporters would come out to where I trained and ask me questions. My friend Lorne Michaels, best known as the creator of Saturday Night Live, used to say every mother in Canada wanted their sons to grow up like me. So I was visible. I was a middle class kid. I mean, people treated me very, very gently. But I had a black teammate, Harry Jerome, who was treated like dirt. I had a female track teammate, Abby Hoffman, who was always marginalized and ridiculed. And they started bringing me into the kind of issues that they faced. And I don't know when it first happened, but they both began to ask me if I could speak out on their behalf, which I had no trouble doing. They were my friends, they were my teammates. I had a voice that was respected. I began to use that voice. The first time I used it in a prominent way, I think 1962 or 1963, when I was Canada's Athlete of the Year and at a big sports banquet in Toronto, because of that award, I was the keynote speaker. And I decided to take advantage of that opportunity to say, we romanticize sport, but not all is perfect in sport. There is racism, there is sexism, there is corruption. I knew some of it firsthand. I read about some of it, and I put together a speech, highly critical. And I said, for those of us who love sport, we've also got to be part of the solution. I mean, I was in second or third year university. I said it with anger. I could see people, just ducking under their tables. People were very upset by that. One of the very famous US athletes on the diets sent me a note challenging me to a fight after the banquet. 2 weeks later, he was suspended from the NFL for betting on his own team. Anyway, it was that kind of thing. In the days ahead, sports media all across country just tore strips off me. Why doesn't Bruce grow up? Why doesn't he learn some respect? All of this kind of stuff. However, being a competitor, it's very hard to remember my 21-year-old self. But gradually, I learned to be more diplomatic. Gradually, I learned to make allies before I did something like that. Gradually, I learned in many cases to go to people and see whether they would change things first. It took me about 10 years to figure out how to do it. I learned that I could use my platform, use the beneficial image that I had to come to the aid of others who were not so well treated. And I learned that if I put my critiques in diplomatic language, a lot of on the one hand, on the other hand, a lot of using examples of where it worked, I could actually get people on side. Although there were some other embarrassing moments on the road. I mean, it was the 60s, and in my generation in the 60s, at one point, love making people mad at us. But anyway, I gradually matured out of that and learned to use my voice as a platform for change.
And Bruce, this was what, 60 years ago, and even in the last few years, you still hear the term just shut up and play, right? When athletes, use their platform to try to affect change. And 60 years ago, Bruce Kidd was, using his voice and creating positive change. So it,
John,
yeah.
I was secure. I was a middle class kid. I was in a good university. My parents had always taught me to stand up for myself and to make change in the areas that were important to me. But I knew lots of people. I mean, one of my dearest friends, when I spoke about this, I asked for his support. He said, "Bruce, if I said a word about this, I'd lose my scholarship." So I have to acknowledge that I was able to speak from a point of privilege when a lot of athletes, particularly professional athletes, were unable to do so. But I'm pleased to say that the young Bruce kid figured out how to do it.
Bruce, when you look at the world and all of its many issues going on today and the platform that athletes have, what goes through your mind?
Well, there's a lot of stuff still to fight. I'm engaged in two issues, which I'd pleased to be tell you about. But many more athletes in Canada, in the United States, in professional sport, in the Olympic sports, have realized that if they don't speak out, maybe nobody will. And that if they band together in unions or in national associations or even international associations, they can affect change. It's not going to be instantaneous. They've got to do their homework. They've got to get their facts right. They've got to forge alliances with their friends in sport, but they can act on those responsibilities. And we've seen this over and over again all over the world.
First of all, we're thrilled to have you. And this, I'm more interested in listening to what you're focused on now and where, as Tim alluded to, there's so many areas that are in need of improvement. Where are you focusing your energies? Where can we all make the best positive change?
Well, there are two issues that I didn't start out raising. The first is the tremendous health harms resulting from the uncritical explosion of sports betting in the age of the social media. And the way that that explosion is poisoning the values of sport, opening sport up to much more game manipulation, and unleashing a new wave of athlete abuse. If you told me 3 or 4 years ago that I'd be working on this, I would have laughed and said, "You're crazy." But seeing the explosion of ads since legalization in the United States in 2018 and legalization in Canada in 2021, and the way that they have just taken over sports coverage, particularly live sports, and addicted, and I'm saying that seriously, addicted millions of Canadians and Americans to sports betting is really, really frightening. I wrote one op-ed about it, expressing my concern, but my argument with those who said that sports betting is good for sport because it adds to the interest in sport, pointing out that all of sports betting is now on handheld casinos and it disembodies sport. It's not the kind of moving through space and time that I always love. It's not games with other and against other people in a tremendous enriching culture, whether you win or lose, but it's by yourself on a handheld. And it's not even about, since most of the bets are prop bets on who's going to score the first goal or who's going to throw the first red card, all of that. So I wrote an op-ed about that. But very quickly, I realized from the mental health people who called, it's an engineered addiction. And the numbers in Canada certainly were going through the roof. And I looked around to see who was doing something, and nobody was doing something. And so with a group of my old sports friends, and we're all, old guys who barely use the social media, we formed a campaign to get governments in Canada simply to ban the ads. The international experience from the WHO, the World Health Organization, down is the most effective way to limit the harms is to reduce the ads. That's the campaign I'm engaged with. We have colleagues, comrades in other countries a well-established group in the United States called Stop Predatory Gambling, which has been around and doing some amazing things. They sort of think we are naive because we focus on sports betting. And they say, Bruce, sports betting is just the entry drug to online casino betting and many more harmful practices. So we're still in a learning curve, but I'm spending a lot of time on that. And we have legislation to regulate the ads working its way through the Canadian Parliament and a new private members bill now in the legislature of Ontario.
Well, Bruce, thank you for that. And I'm hoping whatever happens in Canada can then also be implemented here in the United States, because we are, we're in some cases in even a worse position. And Tim and I interviewed a gentleman, Danny Funt, a few weeks back. He wrote a great book on the
It's a great
negative.
book.
Great book.
Yeah,
And
everybody loses for those out
yeah,
there who want to check it out.
and he said, we could have learned some things from Canada and from Europe. So the fact that you're saying there's that much addiction in Canada obviously does not bode well
Yeah,
here
that's
in the United
alarming.
States.
From the national surveys, it's increased six times
Wow.
since legalization.
We're here with Bruce Kidd, Canadian Sports Hall of Famer, Olympic runner, scholar, author. Bruce, you said you have a second issue that you're focusing on nowadays, so I don't want to go any further without asking you to tell us about that one.
So I'm very much involved in the campaign against the international sex test, which is now a resumed mandatory genetic test, which will have the effect of eliminating a large number of intersex athletes, most of whom come from Africa and Asia, from the Olympic sports, and may, although the numbers are very, very low, also exclude trans athletes from those sports. It's another issue that I learned about from people who came to me asking for help, where I was able to use my influence as I studied the issue, as I became involved in a national task force looking at it, an issue, I became convinced that there's no evidence to say that even if there is some benefit in natural testosterone to athletes from Africa and Asia raised as girls and women, it's no greater than other genetic variations that give advantage in sport. It used to be the Olympic movement celebrated diversity and applauded and admired champions wherever they came from, no matter how tall they are, how broad their reach is, how many fast twitch fibers they have. If they were outstanding ethical sports people, we applauded them. But now there's this campaign against black and brown women for Africa and Asia who want to run as women because that's how they were identified at birth. And they've been raised. And that troubled me. Presented with the evidence, I could see the evidence against the ban persuasive. And it's another issue on which I'm using my voice.
All right, Bruce, I'm going to ask you to put on your professor hat, maybe pull it on a little bit tighter here. Because when you use the term intersex, which I'm going to guess that there's a lot of people out there who either are unfamiliar or only vaguely familiar. So I'm going to ask you to define it for us. And I know you were just describing intersex athletes, but if you could define it for us and tell us a little bit more about how that plays out in sports, how common it is to find intersex athletes, especially those looking to compete or competing at the international level.
Okay, intersex refers to women with differences of sexual development, which means that their sexual organ development may not conform or may vary from what is the majority of female sexual development. They may have testes, they may lack some or all of their ovaries. They are different. They predominate in the global south, although there are certainly those in our countries that are born this way. In the overwhelming majority of cases, they are not diagnosed at birth. They come out of the womb looking as female. They're called female, they're braced as female, they're grown up, they grow up as female. They may never know as they go into sport that that they are. They may have some masculine characteristics, but those characteristics, depending how a culture defines them, are pretty widespread. The best known such athletes are Caster Semenya, who is a now retired 800 meter runner from South Africa, who at times when she was allowed to run, won three world championships and two Olympic titles. But because she has a deep voice and is very muscular, people immediately suspected that she might be a man, and she was outed. And this whole round of genetic testing, which was abolished in the 1990s, has now been brought back to exclude her. The other woman is Dutee Chand, an Indian sprinter who was expelled from the Indian national team after she was tested. And while she thought it was a doping test, a blood sample suggested that she had, and at the time, the fear was that the women like Dutee and Castor have too much natural testosterone and therefore have an unfair advantage. So that's the last 10 or 15 years has seen round after round of new tests to exclude such women, and then appeals on human rights grounds against those tests, many of which have been successful, and then a new test to try again. And the latest round, the mandatory genetic test, is probably the fourth attempt to exclude such women. The target is mostly intersex women, and most of those women come from Africa and Asia.
Well, Bruce, I applaud your efforts and your focus on both issues. Thank you for that for a lot of our listeners. Just one as we wrap up here, I do want to make sure our listeners and our viewers are aware that there's a lot more Bruce Kidd stories and background, and I would love to, for our listeners, just talk about your recent book, A Runner's Journey, and what was the catalyst to put all these words on paper?
Well, thank you very much, John. It's an honor to be on your show. When I was a young athlete, there were a number of sports writers who came forward to and said, "You know, I'd like to write your memoir. You don't have to do anything. Maybe we could sit down with a tape recorder, but I'll write it." Initially, that was very flattering, but I was very proud of my own sense of self. And I had one experience where I knew a sports writer, a very good sports writer, who had written Marilyn Bell's memoir of being the first woman to swim across Lake Ontario in 1954, I believe. He was very proud of the fact that he wrote her memoir without having to talk to her. And it was only when the galleys were coming out that he took the precaution of phoning her up with a few questions just to make sure that if someone asked, she would say, "Yes, I talked to him." I shuddered about that, and I vowed that if the chance ever came, I'd write my own memoirs. Well, I procrastinated and procrastinated and procrastinated. But eventually, my wife and two brothers said, "Bruce, you've been saying for years you're going to write a memoir. If you don't do it soon, you're never going to write it." And one of my brothers said, "You know, if you don't write your memoir, I'll write mine. And that will be even more embarrassing to you." Sibling rivalry. So I eventually did, and it was during COVID. The good news is that I'll try not to string this out too long, but the good news is that I never threw anything out. So I saved newspaper clippings and memorabilia and letters and documents that I collected. I had a number of boxes. I was able to get a small grant to get a museum student to do to catalog them and put them in organized way. And I placed them in the U of T archives, and I would go down because it was a safe site, and go through these boxes and gradually put that book together. The good news is that the stories that I told for years that people that inspired that prompted people to get me to ask me to write this memoir were true for the most part. My biggest fear when I came to write would be that I had been telling whoppers about my life, and that when I actually saw the documents, I would be so disabused that I would give up. But it turned out that I remembered almost everything accurately. So I could put together my memories, and I could put together the documents that I had and come up with a narrative. It was both a personal story, but it was my reflections on Canadian and international sport over those 60 years. So I thought it was not only an opportunity to tell stories, but to make some observations about the issues that we're talking about here. The culture of North American sport, the battles that were fought and won, and the battles that were lost and still need to be fought.
Bruce, before we go further, this guy wrote Marilyn Bell's memoir and just called her up when the galleys came out. Did she even know the book was happening? Do you know?
You know, I can't remember that, but I do know that that's how autobiographies were written in those period. You know, as often they were a memoir as told to. But as I say, I know I worked for a radio station, CFRB in Toronto, working my way through university. And the guy who did that, you know, was a close colleague, and he boasted about that. He wrote a number of best-selling books as told to. But in that one, I know for sure that's what he smiled about.
Well, I mean, as a writer, honestly, Bruce, it feels crazy to say congrats and thank you for waiting to write your own book,
Yeah.
but I'm so glad. I'm so glad you
Yeah.
did.
Bruce, I only think our guest is Bruce Kidd. The book, the memoir, as written by the actual author,
Yeah.
is A Runner's Journey. Bruce, you are not, however, finished writing future chapters. So I look forward to this book, but I also look forward to version two, version three, as the chapters continue to be written.
Oh, thank you very, very much.
I want to thank you for joining us here on Skin in the Game, and look forward to following the future change that you're making in the world of sport. Thank you, Bruce.
Thanks, Bruce.
John and Tim, thank you very, very much. It's been an honor to talk with you this afternoon.
Tim, we've had a lot of great guests on Skin in the Game.
And this one was just wow.
Wow is right.
Wow.
And
Yeah.
we didn't even touch on half of our outline because Bruce, thank goodness, you know, took over the show and talked about the unbelievable impact he's made in sport. And I just want to say, when we started this program, Skin in the Game, you know, we talked about how sport is bigger than X's and O's. Sports is bigger than trophies. Sports impacts, you know, society, health and wellness, economy. And Bruce, in my mind, is the poster child for what Skin in the Game is all about.
He really is. And you know, when John brings on a guest, or when I bring on a guest, depending who, you know, who was the person who brought in that guest, we do create a very detailed outline. You and I both sit here and check off what we've covered. So much is not checked here. And you know, I'm thinking, I mean, Bruce is an officer of the Order of
Yeah, and
Canada, which is a huge
that's a
deal.
big deal.
Big, big
That's a
deal.
big deal. And his focus with an officer of the Order of Canada was to make change, to eliminate sexism, to eliminate bigotry in sport. Big, big issues that he had the platform and he was a voice of change.
And I think back to a conversation you and I had almost a year ago now with S.L. Price, Scott Price, mm-hmm. the great longtime Sports Illustrated writer who, you know, who went on to write books, and he wrote a great book on lacrosse and you know, and what happened with the sport of lacrosse, which was created many, many generations ago, centuries ago, by indigenous people. And it, you know, it's been co-opted over the years, right? And I remember that conversation with Scott Price. And he said, you know, I love writing about sports because it is a window into every part of society. Bruce has done that. And again, he has worked as a journalist and a writer, but what he's utilized sports for, is a window into issues that need to be addressed by people who are leaders. And he was doing it decades before other people were. Right. You know, you see it all the time now. You didn't see it all the time in the 60s.
Well, you see it all the time now, but yeah. Every now and then you still get pushback, as I mentioned, you know, hey, just shut up and play. You still get pushback from some fans, some media, you know, some league officials that say, don't mix politics and sport. But especially when there's public money involved, they're joined at the hip.
Right. And, you know, a question, if we have Bruce back, a question I wanted to get into him is, when you look at, you know, NFL players kneeling on the sideline during a national anthem, right? When you look at athletes speaking out about trans athletes playing in their sport, intersex athletes, you know, who I think if people are only partially paying attention, which is easy to do when you just see, you know, controversy after breaking news after alert coming through on your phone, it could be easy to conflate those two things, and they're not the same thing, not at all, right?
Yeah.
To see him speak out with clarity and to stand up for something a lot of people aren't standing up for,
right?
You know, I think that really, really stood.
Yeah. Well, think about it too. Here in, you know, south of the border, here in the United States, you know, the first athlete I can remember kind of being that societal voice was Muhammad Ali.
Right.
That was, what, late 60s? So Bruce...
And he stood out then for doing it, and Bruce was ahead
of that. Was 4 or 5 years before Muhammad Ali ever spoke up. Whether it was Muhammad Ali, whether it was Jim Brown, whether it was Will Chamberlain, those guys were late 60s, early 70s. Bruce was, you know, on the podium, at least being this voice, years before that.
Which is why he is such a revered figure in Canada. So. Yeah.
Bruce Kidd, the book is A Runner's Journey, written and documented by Bruce Kidd.
Yeah, great book, great writer, great man.
Yeah.
And so happy to have him on the show.
And real quick, before we wrap up here, we did make note of an episode with Danny Funt, who wrote a book called
Everybody Loses.
And Bruce acknowledged that book as well, and talked about, you know, the negative impact of sports betting. So I really encourage all of our listeners, go back a few episodes and do listen to the episode with Danny Funt. It's very eye-opening on what's happening in both the U.S. and Canada when it comes to sports betting.
When Bruce was talking about the prop bets, where people can, you know, bet on just one little thing that may or may not happen during the game, I was going back to our Danny Funt conversation where, you know, Danny was talking and he writes about athletes sitting on their phones in the locker room after the game, getting threatening DMs, you know, because they happen to come out of the game or go into the game and make a shot or miss a shot.
Right. Getting harassed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Because of prop betting.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. Well, there's many issues, and Bruce is tackling two big ones. So thanks again for that. And thanks for listening to Skin in the Game, and look forward to catching up again next week. Skin in the Game is a production of Buffalo Toronto Public Media. You can catch up with all past episodes on btpm.org or on the Buffalo Toronto Public Media YouTube channel. Thanks for listening.